welcome to the Global Economy Podcast. My name is David Hennig, and I run the UK Trade Policy Project at ESIP. Today we'll be hearing the live recording from the panel discussion of our event on After Brexit, What's Next for UK-EU Relations, which we held just a couple of days after the UK formally left the EU on January the 31st. We discussed some questions around that, such as how can the EU and the UK find a new sustainable partnership? What agreement is achievable and likely in 2020? And will the absence of the UK mean a move towards a closed EU? We had an excellent panel with Anna Stellinger from the Confederation of Swedish Industry, Elvire Fabry from the French think tank the Delors Institute, myself, and moderated by Emily Rees from Trade Strategies, who's the next voice you will hear.
Welcome, everybody, to the European Centre for International Political Economy this afternoon. My name is Emily Rees, and I'm very glad to see so many of you turn up for this really important conversation about Brexit and what's next for EU-UK relations. There's been quite a lot happening this morning, but we heard that free trade is God's diplomacy from the UK. So I'd like to turn to our saints of trade negotiations here, in particular, David Hennig, the director of the UK Trade Policy Project here at ESIP, Anna Stellinger, who's the director of international and EU affairs at the Confederation of Swedish Enterprise, formerly from the National Board of Trade of Sweden, and Elvire Fabry, who's a senior research fellow at Jacques Delors Institute. So, David, perhaps we'll start with you. What's your take on what happened this morning?
Thank you, Emily. Interesting times. So let's reflect a bit on that. And what we were reflecting on last year when we produced a report on future relations between UK and EU and the involvement of Sweden was that this is fundamentally not just about the UK-EU relationship, potentially. It was going to also be about the future of the EU. The UK relationship is the biggest deal, the biggest trade deal the EU will be doing under this commission. That's not somehow widely recognised. The EU will miss the UK push for openness, and I think that that is already happening. But realistically, the way that the UK is handling matters has actually made this easy for the Commission to just think, okay, we'll just put the UK into a free trade agreement box. That there are some serious questions that should be asked about potential future relationship models and whether the UK ever really fitted into any model or whether you need something particularly bespoke. But if the UK says no to lots of things, says no level playing field, says no regulatory alignment, no ECJ, well, that is bound to mean this is a distant relationship. You can't have a close relationship given that that is not just about the EU, that is about Europe-wide cooperation that is taking place, and the UK is effectively rejecting quite a few of the fundamental building blocks. So in terms of where we are, I think what I would say is that although there have been lots of different speeches by different prime ministers in the UK, our base position in the UK remains the UK wants a deal on our terms. We want preferences without obligations. We want no ECJ, no alignment. But we're never quite sure where the red lines are. And that's something that I would say about Boris Johnson's speech today, is that it's all very well saying my red lines are I want these things. But his red lines were also he wasn't going to have a border down the Irish Sea, and we know what happened. So it's fair for the EU to say, well, let's just test those red lines, because on the basis of the red lines as they are, it will be hard to reach any kind of agreement. We don't believe them. The UK then says in return, why do you not want to give us a free trade agreement? So there is a danger of this going off into a difficult direction. Arguably, the EU hasn't moved too much since 2016 either. No cherry picking, no special deals, focus on the detail, and ready to deal with whatever the UK decides it wants and then fit into a model. And I don't think they've changed much today either, with Barnier's presentation, the publication of the draft mandate. We should be clear, this is only a draft mandate. The Council has not yet agreed the mandate. And then the Boris Johnson speech, and also there's been a written statement which fleshed it out only a very small amount. So that's not been much shared. Between the two of them, it doesn't appear to be the basis for a sustainable UK-EU relationship. That is, I think, the headline, I would say. And I think that we are talking about a 10-year project potentially to find the basis of a stable relationship. I'm not, you know, whether we get a trade deal at the end of this year or not, I think is 50-50 right now. Mm. It will require the UK to cross some of its red lines, and it will require the EU to be a little bit more flexible than they would like, I think. Where are we headed to? From an EU point of view, what are the main things here is that we've learned is I think that the UK doesn't fit in to an existing model. I think that the Barnier waterfall, we're beginning to realise it was an illustration. It should not be treated as these are your choices, because it's quite clear that none of the choices the UK could just take off the shelf. All would require negotiation, and I think that's one of the problems now. It is a chance, and this is something that we looked at in the report last year, this is a chance for the EU to think about a new model, because there are countries around the periphery that have tricky relations with the EU. The UK is going to be another one. The EU has huge numbers of individual agreements with lots of countries around the world. Many of them are not structured particularly well. So the UK could be an opportunity to say, right, how do we structure a relationship going forward? The problem being, as I said before, the UK doesn't make that easy. Because it seems that we don't want that sort of thing. We, you know, ultimately we may get there, but it may take some time. And from a UK point of view as well, and this is where I think the vision of the UK comes in, how do we support an open trading relationship, but based on the kind of rules and level playing field provisions that the EU would like for all trade relations? And I think that's a big challenge. From a UK point of view, our government is immature in matters of trade. Until we have serious political discussion, any view lacks stability. The UK has other big problems like the economic structure, how that may change in the future as a result of Brexit. That could, for example, have major impacts on the car industry, pharmaceuticals, other sectors, financial services perhaps less so. But also the UK is going to be like some kind of teenager demanding respect, I think. We want respect, we want to be a player. And that's not necessarily easy either. I mean, normally all of this is, of course, why trade deals take time. They don't take time on the detail. They may take a year or two on the detail. But the other years are in terms of actually having the two sides understand each other. And obviously the UK saying we can do it all in 10 months fundamentally fails to appreciate why you normally take so long. So it is going to be tricky. And there are strong forces against a good future relationship. We've just been through a divorce. It has an impact. And I think we see that it has an emotional and psychological impact. And I think that's what we see going through now. And however much it might be denied on both sides, certainly at this, you know, a few months ago, I was still saying I don't think the EU was coping with it, was really believing it was going to happen. Well, it's happened, but I'm not sure the EU has really understood why it happened. Not sure the UK has either, actually. Don't think either side really understand why we got to a divorce or what it means or what it should mean in the future. So that's huge challenges ahead. So we have an EU with structure wanting to go for detail, a UK with sort of visions. It's a real conundrum. I think we can get to a stable relationship over time, something flexible that can allow for developments, that can allow for agreements or divergences in different areas. But it will be very difficult to do this year.
So, David, before we listen to the trade policy adult in the room, which tends to be Sweden.
Oh, yes.
I'm older than you, David.
can I just ask you a very quick question? You mentioned, so what was published by the Commission this morning was a draft negotiating mandate. In your view, why would the Commission publish a piece which is not final at this early stage?
I mean, clearly, the Commission, since TTIP days, which I think we were involved in one way or another, since TTIP days, there has been a big push anyway towards transparency. But there is definitely a sense of the Commission setting out the stall. The UK is taking charge of the timescale, if you like, and did that happen in phase one. So the UK says, well, this is our timescale. So the Commission says, well, this is our response. So I think it is part of the negotiating strategy now of the Commission to set out clearly what it wants. It's a way of saying to the UK, this is serious. You can't just make this all up, just airily talk about free trade. This is what it means. These are the things we have to discuss. So I think it's quite clever, but there is a danger of the Commissioner talking about detail and the UK talking sort of generalities. There is a danger of the two sides talking past each other.
Right, and now from the point of view of Sweden, I could imagine that the UK will actually be quite missed in the council. And what's the view from a Swedish perspective on this divorce and what comes next?
Yeah, well, perhaps just a few points on why Sweden is I wouldn't say the adult in the room, but very concerned about the Brexit process. Well, first of all, the UK has always been Sweden's biggest ally. If you look at the statistics, our countries have almost always voted the same. Cap, budget, free trade. It's a free trading nation, 10 million people, small country, and it's been very handy to hold the UK's hand and to have the UK to develop a free trading Europe. So we'll be missing that. Secondly, I remember that it was midsummer. Perhaps some of you know what midsummer is. It's the biggest feast in Sweden. It's the biggest national day in Sweden. And that was midsummer 2016 when we had the results of the referendum in the UK. Kind of special. All the headlines in all the newspapers were about the huge sadness. There's a consensus in Sweden among some of our biggest industries, company leaders, that this was the darkest day of their professional career. That's the general feeling in Sweden. And then, of course, free trading nation, a government that prepared itself very early. I'm partly guilty of that. I used to be director general of the National Board of Trade in Sweden. We made a 350 pages long analysis on what sectors, what specific rules and regulations are important to maintain in order to continue to have as free, smooth trade as possible. So Sweden is kind of special in that case. I missed half of the day because I was in an airplane. And I think it's kind of speaking that the Brexit roller coaster has been going on for 3.5 years. I take the plane from Stockholm, which lasts 2 hours, and I know that I will have missed something. I mean, we have been so busy with this Brexit story since 2016 that sometimes we need to go back to basics. And what I try to do when I speak to our companies in Sweden is just to show some very simple figures so that we don't only focus on what's going on in the Tory or the Labour parties, because this is much a bigger question than that. In Sweden, we actually have 66,000 jobs thanks to our exports. Of course, you know, we can't really count on how many jobs we have thanks to imports, but 66,000 is kind of huge for a country like Sweden. UK is our sixth most important country for exports in goods, seventh for imports. When it goes to services, this is really important and will be really important for many countries, because we're good at exporting services, but we're good at importing services from the UK also. And we know that services will be tricky in the upcoming negotiations. And when you look at the number of employed in Swedish companies in the UK, 75,000 in UK companies in Sweden, 43,000. Just to give you globally, we count 100,000 jobs in Sweden that we have thanks to our trade with the UK. So that's a country of 10 million. It's not small numbers. What we also need to say is that it's so funny. We keep talking about CETA all the time. I get almost aggressive when we talk about CETA. I'm not going to get angry here, but it's like CETA is some kind of off-the-shelf magic solution. Have anybody, this is the CETA agreement. I held it in my hand in Canada. Has anybody read it? Oh, I'm so sorry for those five people here. But I mean, obviously nobody normally constituted would read 1,300 pages. And of course, these are a lot of annexes. It's not all text, but this is a trade agreement. This is what trade agreements are about. And it's chapters on goods, and it's chapters on services, and it's chapters of trade and sustainable development. This is just not something you take off the shelf and you just erase Canada and you put the United Kingdom and that's it. It's not a magic solution. And what we keep saying, what we need to keep saying also, let's say that we actually put all the staff we have in the EU and all the staff we have in the UK to negotiate the most formidable trade agreement we have ever seen by the end of this year. We know that even with that trade agreement, we will have substantial costs in time and administration for all companies who want to trade with the UK. You cannot think that a trade agreement would give us any, just remove all the necessary controls, will not remove the external borders, will not remove all the paperwork that we need in order to make safe that we, the food we give to our babies are safe, and the beef we serve is not prepped with hormones. I mean, this is a trade agreement. It's boring, it's long, it's thousands of pages of text, and it's hugely important. So it's not, to me, a political question. It's a it's a question of trade engineering. We must go down to the nitty-gritty. Then another bad news is that we've been discussing all this for such a long time, all the alternative models for future relationships. And we have the Norway solution, we have the Turkey solution with the customs union, we have Switzerland with all the bilateral agreements, we have the DCFTA like we have with Ukraine, we have GATS and GATT and EFTA, and we have Japan, and this could be filled up with even more examples. We must be really clear that none of these models, none of these examples, even with like 5 or 50 or 100 pluses after CETA plus, 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 I won't do 50 pluses, but you get the idea. None of them would come even remotely close to the facility we have of trading, the free flow of people and services and goods and data and investment and capital that we need in order to trade today. So bad news. One thing also, probably we need to step down the stairs for several reasons. Well, having a CETA or a South Korea or even a Japan agreement is nothing that you can do in 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. That's the way it goes. And since there are more and more red lines, this is an important day with all the mandates and all what's going on, but since we have a lot of red lines, it's possible that we need to look at what would these stairs look if we actually went further down to the basement. That's where we're at. And then the funny part, I don't know if you like Swedish smorgasbord, but there's a lot of food going on. There's this salami method of doing a trade agreement, slicing it up. Somebody said there was a ravioli, and I don't really get that picture. Then, of course, we have the CETA sector by sector, taking chapter by chapter. And then the Lego, I feel very much for the Lego, being Swedish, is almost like, you know, Lego comes from Denmark. But when I listen to the Swedish government, and I've been working a lot with them during those last years, I get the impression that we were more like the Lego kind of negotiations. You know, I don't know, you're not in the age of playing Lego here, I see. But normally you have this like ground grey thing that you put the Lego things on. And what we need to do to the end of the year is to lay the ground floor that we can put the Lego bits and pieces on. 2021, 2022.
I should have brought my Lego for my children.
We could have done it.
Build our own trade agreement.
They can teach you something. Trade will continue. This is something that we need also to be. We do trade with the US. We do trade with China. We do trade with Brazil. It's not the end of the world. We will still be trading. It will be more friction, higher cost, and what our companies are really worried about is the increased uncertainty. Because diverging from rules, and what we hear is that we will keep some rules, we will not keep others, we will diverge for some, and some we will just, you know, follow the European standards or rules and regulations. And how do you act when you're driving a business when you don't know what rules will apply in 6 months? Final. So what should we do? Well, I'm speaking on behalf of the Swedish companies. This is what they tell us. It's been so much about Tories this and Labour that and Parliament this and elections and referenda. And we need to continue to develop the single market. I mean, that's where most of our business is done. It's the best free trade agreement the world has ever produced. I mean, if we need a gold standard, this is the gold standard. Secondly, keep the level of ambition high. Even if we can't do the entire Lego building, we should at least be very pushy about not lowering the ambitions, because that will come at a high cost for jobs. Put external pressure. You know, the free trade agreements, but also the agreements in the WTO, they are never as successful when there's somebody pushing from the outside. I can draw the parallel to the Uruguay round that would have never succeeded in the WTO if it wasn't from external pressure, also from businesses. That's what we have to do this time, at least from a Swedish perspective, if we want a good free trade agreement. This is perhaps not what French and German people want to see. But from a Swedish perspective, I think it's important that we keep an eye on the French-German positions. We are not France, we are not Germany, n'est-ce pas, Elvire? And we will not have the same interests during the negotiations. So super important that even if we're just 10 million, we are a free trading nation with some competence when it comes to free trade agreements. And we should definitely not fall into the French-German positions. Last but one, continue the strong relationship with the UK. And this is absolutely paramount. We might have to have hook up with the UK businesses. I don't know how we will do it. Somehow we will have to keep a very strong relationship with the UK because it's a country that will remain hugely important and it will be our ally once we have come over the divorce that has been going on for 3.5 years. Continue the dialogue with the government and the EU Commission. One should not overestimate their capacity in knowing exactly what it means for business to trade, what it means to work with rules of origin, what it means with all the certificates, etc. needed. We need to have this dialogue during all the time of the negotiations. Be the voice of reason, voice of business. Not be quiet. Not just continue looking at what's going on in the UK. And this is the last one, really tricky. Try as far as possible to fill the void from the UK. Because let's remember that even if things are a bit infected at the moment, the UK is a great trading nation, has played a very important role, not just blocking the EU, but also brought content to the EU when it comes to holding the free trading agenda high, keeping the budget slim, and doing things that can be kind of sensitive. And now that the UK is out, we other countries need to step up and be more vocal. And that's it.
Thank you. So essentially, Anna, what we're learning now is that trade agreements don't come in IKEA kits.
Well, they do come in, you know, those IKEA kits that you can actually never build because when you're at page 98, you have already divorced your husband, your kids are hungry, everybody's... Now, free trade agreements are, it's an art of trade nerds engineering, and we need to really respect that trade agreements is not something that you do in a political afternoon when you agree on something. It's hard work, and it if it takes time, it's because we want good agreements. We could do a bad agreement very quickly, but that's simply not an option for business.
Which takes us really to the question of time. And I'm turning here to Elvire, who has extensive trade experience and will be able to perhaps share some of the more continental views on what's just been discussed. But we're hearing a couple of things here. One, which is that these processes they're long, they're tedious, they're technical. Do we have the time to get an agreement done by what would be November, essentially, because it would have to go to a parliamentary vote by December in order to not end up with yet another cliff edge? And coming back to the comments on France and Germany, we saw this morning the Prime Minister of the UK take quite a strong stance on state aid of France and Germany. We felt that these were really the countries that were being highlighted in that speech. I'd be very interested to have your point of view on the moteur franco-allemand and what that will mean for the next stages and how other countries should sort of find their way and their path in that. And perhaps a last point, which is that Anna brought up right now, which is this is a first. It's the first time we're actually negotiating to diverge. So there is no template for a split up of this kind. So, Elvire?
Thank you. For all the menu. Well, we're definitely feeling a strong sense of urgency. There's no time left, and it was interesting to see this morning the contest between Johnson and Barnier to be the one to present the guidelines. And beyond the sadness of this Brexit, what I feel today is the first thing I thought this morning is, okay, finally we may get to the point when we may have the possibility to move from the sort of abstract symbolic Brexit to a more real Brexit? What's behind Brexit? Because for the moment, we don't have a clear strategy beyond Brexit. Sovereignty doesn't make a strategy. I would say the first reality is that the UK gave up the possibility to influence from the inside the first global trade power, which is a real, that's something real. And the other reality is that today it is a third country, not any third country. And that says a lot about the challenge of this negotiation. While, I mean, we have, of course, a very special relation, as, of course, Anna was underlining. But as on the UK side, it means that the UK is calling for special concessions. On the EU side, they're calling for more special conditionality, precisely because of this strong interdependence. So how we move on from those two very different positions in, as you say, 8 months, because the time is really running. What are the objectives and what are the risks? On the UK side, it means giving reality to the take back control. We have very two symbolic chapters with fishery, with regulatory autonomy. And Boris Johnson has been really, let's say, posturing this weekend like a fighter getting ready to come to the ring, saying there will be, regulatory autonomy means regulatory autonomy, means full divergence. What does it mean? What does it mean? It doesn't tell for the moment really what will be the level of divergence. I think we shouldn't let's make no mistake, on the EU side, the EU is taking for granted the willingness of the UK to recover its full regulatory autonomy, but that's why for the EU the starting point is not, I mean, it's less how to manage the divergence, and that's why you were right to say we have to take distance from those different models. It's more to consider the UK now as a third country, relying on WTO terms, and how we're going to build from that. What kind of cooperation are we going to build from there? And that's a very different perspective. And the big challenge for the UK is in that grey zone of divergence, how is it going to manage the gravitation force of the EU regulatory ecosystem, which is not, I mean, it's the whole architecture of a regulatory ecosystem on which the single market is lying, that is at stake. So what does it mean on the EU side? It's not only about limiting the costs. Of course, we have to limit the cost because we are completely interdependent. And for France, the UK is the first trade surplus on agriculture. It's a key EU. I mean, we don't have so many trade surplus. So it's we are particularly interested with this one, to keep this one on track. But beyond that pragmatic approach, there is a more existential issue, which has to see precisely with that regulatory ecosystem on the EU side. During the withdrawal process, Europeans have succeeded to constitutionalize, in a way, the indivisibility of the four freedoms. It has been a key step. Now, it's all about demonstrating that neither environmental, social, competition policy, climate, and other elements are not optional in the regulatory ecosystem, and that trying to separate one of those sectors of regulation would create some dumping and some distortion in the level playing field system of the EU. Maybe France is particularly nervous on the environmental, I mean, would tend to be particularly stringent on the environmental issue, but let's not try to separate those sectors. Brexit cannot be dealt in abstracto, like trying to deal with a bilateral relation. It happens at a specific moment. If it had happened 10 years ago, maybe it would have been different. It's happening now. In a moment, in the international framework of a trade war, trade confrontation, but it's happening at a moment when the Europeans have decided to tackle more actively the dumping challenge, regulatory dumping challenge coming from emerging economies and emerged economies as China. And we know that from last spring, we have a new agenda on trying to really to focus on the distortion coming from the Chinese practice of state aid. So how can we not be stringent on the risk of distortion coming from divergence on state aid on the Brexit battlefield, while at the same moment we're trying precisely to address those issues in regards towards China, just to take an example. So maybe the broad perspective on that is post-Brexit going to be a moment to a turning point for Europeans to set up some new standards in terms of living playing field? Maybe it's a sort of more increasing, more ambitious perspective for this issue, and a more complex one in addition to what was already in the menu. But I think it has we see that really level playing field, I mean, is the muscle of this negotiation at the moment. What are the risks? There are many, so many. I tend to think that beyond the posturing attitude of Johnson about divergence, he has so much interest in remaining quite ambiguous on the kind of divergence he will opt for the UK. He has so much to lose to be clear in the first initial steps of this negotiation. The same on the US side. He has much interest in keeping some ambiguity. And he has a lot of leeway on his on the way he's going to negotiate these those talks. He has released himself from parliamentary supervision when we look at the withdrawal bill. Deep fatigue in the British public opinion, strong confidence in the capacity that he will have to confront the Europeans. That leaves a lot of leeway, as much to diverge concretely and as much to build in the end a narrative allowing to stay closer to the EU, but dressed in a narrative that would be convenient for the British public opinion. I think that at least talking about the method, about the Lego, how we engaging in this negotiation, what we hear from those initial from this draft of the Quad Lines, it's that maybe the Europeans are trying to take some distance with what would be the blackmail of tariffs, of no deal, of once again, if the starting point is that the UK is now relying on WTO terms, the issue is not so much only about no deal in the trade field, but it's no deal on all chapters, on data transfer, on fishery, on so that it's not only a trade issue. And I think that's the way the European Commission has decided to address this negotiation, working on governance, what you were calling the grey playground, and allowing to have those parallel negotiations going beyond going beyond December, and precisely as you were saying, that will request probably some 10 years of negotiation. Mm-hmm. And this focus on the governance, on the basic principles, which really try to preserve the existential focus of the Europeans, I would tend to think that France will be really on that line.
Thank you so much, Elvire. May I play devil's advocate with you, especially on this part of the dressing narratives? I think we've had quite a lot of posturing, as you mentioned, over past days. But one point, which is the environmental side, which, as you say, will be extremely important for France, is pushing for climate transition. We have a commission that's also coming up with a very strong agenda with the European Green Deal. Boris Johnson this morning seemed to seem to suggest that out of the EU, the UK could go further quicker. He was talking about single-use plastics, about the animal welfare and so forth. But we have, you know, targets in the UK of GHG reduction of 80% by 2050, which is to many would be actually much higher than a lot of member states have put forward. Is there an option for this? Do you see my point? Is that perhaps these anxieties that the EU have are unjustified? Maybe it is a point to prove that the UK could go further in terms of its climate ambitions and economic transition. And to that point, maybe perhaps to all of you opening up a bit here, tell us more about this level playing field, because I don't know about you, but it's really something that's so complex to get our heads around. What exactly are we talking about? So, Olivier, on the environment in France.
Okay. Well, level playing field. That's precisely we at the moment where we're building something around level playing field in a way. The whole question in this negotiation will be: should we stick to non-regression principle, or should we move on and try to push a little further on with a kind of regulatory dynamic alignment? And where it gets interesting is precisely the example that you're taking with environment. Maybe it would be interesting we can create some common interests between the UK and the EU, if it's not only viewed as something as the EU trying to preserve a higher level of standards and norms in different fields, but that it can be a way to promote some higher standards, and if the UK was to move on more quickly on environmental norms, that could be also a leverage for the Europeans. I mean, it's not only blackmail about trying to impose some higher standards.
So would the level playing field perhaps be able to work the other way around then, which is what the United Kingdom seemed to suggest this morning?
Well, if it's talking precisely about environment, it could even be interesting, seen from the French point of view. And when you hear Michel Barnier this morning talking about long-term level playing field, it suggests that the European Commission might be interested to move on in the direction of that dynamic alignment.
Any thoughts on level playing field?
I could say a word on it, but could you just allow me one comment that I can't help, I need to make. When we speak about this bespoke relationship between the deal between the EU and the UK and the fact that we want a trade deal of the century and the trade deal, I mean, first of all, some kind of sadness that the time constraint here is so heavy that we could have made something good out of Brexit, showing what a real trade deal really should look like. We had a chance of saying, okay, bye-bye to the UK, we're very sorry that you're leaving, but at least we will make something good out of Brexit. If there was another kind of timeline, we could have shown how to make a super standard 2.0 free trade agreements. Now we can't. So we've been crippled of that. And then secondly, once again, saying that free trade agreements are tedious, I insist on that. There are small articles in them, but that really are important. If you look at the CETA agreement, if you look at the Japan agreement, it clearly says that all those ambitious free trade agreements, whatever the EU would give away to the UK in a free trade agreement with the UK, it has retroactively give it to also the others, like Canada and Japan, for instance. So there is an end game. There is a limit on what the EU can give to the UK because it has to give it all to also to the other. I mean, that's the way trade deals are being done in the second generation of EU free trade agreements. And all that might sound like technical details, but it's not. It actually shows that we can go this far, but if we go further than that, we will have to concede the same things to the Canadians and Japanese, for instance. Then secondly, you say that, okay, we will have to vote in November in order to have a deal 1st of January 2021. We are being so optimistical here. While we are talking about words and things that nobody understands, like level playing field, we will have parliaments who will have to vote about this agreement. What makes us feel, believe that we will have all the national and regional parliaments, if it is an ambitious mixed agreement, what makes us think that they will actually say yes? I mean, it's not like we are in a complete ambiance of trust and friendship at the moment. There are so many feelings about Brexit out there. So I think that we need to do our homework and talk about these complicated things in a much more easily understood manner. Otherwise, we will do the best we can in a free trade agreement. We can talk all the world about level playing field, but we will not have the parliaments to vote yes. And I think that we shouldn't miss that tiny detail.
David, coming back on Anna's point here on the retroactivity of concessions, there's another point that we haven't really brought up so far, which is this multidimensional game of chess, to use the exact words from this morning. The fact that the UK is looking to open trade negotiations with other countries at the same time. What's the impact of that on the time, on the technicality, on the concessions that will need to be made?
Well, we just all get even more confused, I think, because we're just saying of how much. I mean, look, I think there's some really interesting points coming out here. One is that once, you know, it's the old Pandora's box, once we're opening this up, there's a huge amount to do. And I think that the public statements of Barnier, of Johnson, they didn't want to go there because that, you know, then says, well, is 10 months really enough? No, of course it isn't. So you're kind of, on the one hand, you're trying, you've got a sort of a public face which says, look, we could do something and we can do something, but versus, oh my God, you know, we've been through this before. We know how long this is. Mm. You know, and this is the work of years. Then you have the UK government, which is not just sitting on this relationship, but is also attempting to negotiate with the EU and the US at the same time, which has been described by negotiators I know who've done it before as horrible, at the same time as negotiating with Japan after Australia, New Zealand. Sorry, I just don't, you know, it's realistically not happening that you can do that. Thinking that it's got lots of leverage, and we have, I keep coming back to this idea, and works in the UK, I don't know if it works in other countries, of the kid who's trying to show they can play with the bigger boys in the playground. And it feels like the UK wants to be with the big boys, but in fact has only just started to learn this themselves. And then back to sort of the EU and level playing field, or just the EU, there's a two conversations going on. There is a real danger of missing the conversations, and it's recalled with listening to Elvira, that one of the oddities of the relationship between the when the UK was in the EU is that in some respects, the country who thinks most alike to the UK, that we agree with the positions of Sweden, but the way we express things is often most similar to France, which is that we express things in a big picture way, but clearly different. So within the EU context, we could both express things in a big picture way, a different big picture, but actually by working that through, that tended to set the framework to help for others. Now, the Commission, as we know, is a more legalistic, member-driven body compared to that. So how do we get over the problem that the UK and the Commission is not a natural negotiating fit? No. The UK, you know, I've heard this, I've been party to conversations between UK diplomats and the Commission, and they're talking a different language. Mm. They genuinely are talking. What one side is saying is totally misunderstood by the other. So there is so much here to do, and it gets scary when you start writing them down. Some of you will know, I sometimes write them down as Twitter threads. I think, you know, after about number 20, I think, oh my God, and I still haven't covered everything that has to do. I mean, sorry, Tony just left. We haven't even talked about the Northern Ireland Protocol that has to be implemented. And you start thinking of all of this and you think, oh my God, it's not
possible.
And you
were talking about the dialogue between politicians and negotiators. Yeah. And then we need to add other layers for the parliaments that will have to vote for this, who will have to have a public debate in their regions or countries or whatever, and the businesses. I'm sorry with this new hat I have, and I'm not going to be a parrot here, but those who use free trade agreements are not politicians. Those who use free trade agreements, who actually use the rules, are the businesses. And those who actually trade in goods and services and people and data and investment and ideas and innovation are not politicians. They are companies. So there's somewhere here along the line that we need to take off the politician hat and start doing some pragmatic work here in order to save those jobs that we will lose otherwise.
Right. Thank you.